Hello, and thanks for turning on The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. I'm Bruce Jacobs, a producer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. In this episode, Donald Rumsfeld explains decisions he made while serving as defense secretary under President George W. Bush. He tells writer-at-large James Kirchick why U.S. forces failed to control the chaos and looting in Iraq immediately after Saddam Hussein fell from power.
Anytime you're changing from one regime to a new regime, there's a transition period that is imperfect. It is inevitable.
The spokesman for WikiLeaks says his organization follows basic journalistic rules and is not so different than a newspaper.
Well, evaluating what should be in the public domain is something that a journalist is doing every day when he gets information.
And in Uzbekistan, the government has no sympathy for what it considers devil music. But we begin with our wide-ranging interview with Donald Rumsfeld. His long record of government service includes stints as defense secretary under Presidents Gerald Ford and George W. Bush. He recounts his long career in his recently released memoir, Known Unknowns. Writer-at-large James Kirchick spoke on the phone with Rumsfeld about Afghanistan, Iraq, Central Asia, and a variety of other topics.
Now, when the U.S. initially invaded Afghanistan, we obviously had to work with various warlords, and you described them in the book as being pretty unsavory characters. Do you think later on, was the integration of these warlords into the government structures a mistake in terms of the post-war work?
No, I don't think so. I think, first of all, I don't know that I described them as unsavory. I think I characterized them in the book where some people had made allegations or suggestions about them. I did not have factual information either to support it or to oppose it, those contentions. They were what they were. They were people who'd been at war in a landlocked country that had suffered a drought, suffered a close to a decade of Soviet occupation, and had had a civil war going on for years. And they were, some called them warlords, some called them tribal leaders, other called them militia generals, whatever one wants to call them. Obviously, they were, for the most part, not Jeffersonian Democrats.
Right.
They were people who lived in Afghanistan and were Afghans doing what was fairly normal in that country. And it was walking away, the best thing in the world for us to do was to work with them.
Right.
They were opposed to the Taliban. They were opposed to Al-Qaeda. And because we worked successfully with them, I say we, meaning the CIA and the Department of Defense Special Forces, because they were able to work successfully with them, the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda were moved out of Afghanistan in very short order.
On that subject, there's obviously been a lot of controversy about the failure to capture Osama bin Laden. In your memoir, you write that no one knew for certain that he was holed up in Tora Bora. But later on, you say that we might be missing an opportunity in Tora Bora. And then you acknowledge, you said you would have sent more troops if General Franks wanted them. Do you regret now not having sent more troops, even though General Franks didn't request them?
No. There was no request for additional capability, either up the CIA chain or the military chain.
Right.
I don't know how someone sitting in Washington, D.C., 5,000 or 6,000 miles away, can make a judgment to the contrary. I kept asking the question.
Right.
And apparently the evidence was not sufficiently persuasive that it either persuaded the people in the CIA chain that more capability was needed, or nor did it persuade the people in the military chain that more capability was needed, which suggests that it may very well not have been needed. So I don't know what you would have sent if there was no indication of what was needed. Furthermore, there was an enormous amount of bombing going on in the Tora Bora area during that entire period.
It's moving on to Iraq. You've downplayed the criticism that the U.S. could have done more to prevent looting in the aftermath of the invasion. Could this have been prevented, though, by stationing more U.S. troops outside particular ministries, or was that unforeseeable?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. I think that looting was clearly a problem that the Central Command had anticipated. Saddam Hussein had let loose 100,000 prisoners from his prison, And he called for jihad, and jihadists came in from Iran and from Syria and from other neighboring countries. It's a large country. The people had been repressed. A number of government buildings, including Saddam Hussein's palaces, people went in and stripped out the wire, so the wires in the buildings, to get the copper. So you can imagine, I mean, think of the looting that took place in Germany. And if one goes back and reads, any time you're changing from one regime to a new regime, there's a transition period that is imperfect. It is inevitable, and it is historic. It's always been so. And you can anticipate it, and they were prepared to impose martial law, Franks and the Central Command. But is it possible, is it conceivable that any kind of looting like that could be eliminated or prevented? I don't know the answer to that question.
You argue that, and quote, one of the most unfortunate, if unnoticed, foreign policy mistakes of our administration, was the American reaction to the May 2005 Andijan massacre in Uzbekistan. And you write in the book that the uprising was spurred by rebels from an Islamist extremist group accused of seeking an Islamic State. Now, there's a DIA memo from July 2005, which you have put on your website and that I've read. And that memo reports that, quote, their motivation almost certainly was anger and frustration over poor socioeconomic conditions and repressive government policies rather than a unifying extremist ideology. Do you stand by your characterization of the Andijan events as being instigated by Muslim extremists, or do you think that the reasons for it had to do with the corruption and the oppression of the Karimov regime?
I certainly stand by what I wrote in the book, but I would add that you can find scraps of intelligence that are on all sides of most issues. And what it requires is analyzing and synthesizing and pulling those threads together and then coming to some judgments about what is likely, because it is not, I don't think, it certainly at the time, we did not have certain knowledge as to what was going on. And my impression is there's still a good deal of debate as to precisely what the motivations were. A fair characterization of my comments in the book would be something like this. There is a natural pattern for those of us in our country that benefit from free, from human rights and civil rights and opportunities, to want that for others and to be critical when a regime doesn't provide that for the people. And that's understandable, and that's a positive thing. On the other hand, if you look around the world, there are only a few handfuls of countries that behave like we do, that have move to a point where they have a sufficiently free political system that we would characterize it as of a kind with Western Europe and ours and Australia and, you know, any number of other countries, South Korea and Japan and the like. But the vast majority of the countries are not arranged the way the countries that I've just indicated illustratively are arranged. So that you look at two things. First, you look at them and say, well, where are they on that spectrum from unfree towards free? And Freedom House, for example,
yes,
analyzes that every year, and you can look at it.
Yeah.
That's one thing to understand, and there's no question but that the Central Asian republics are over towards the less free compared to the United States and some other Western European countries. However, the other thing to look at is which way are they moving? And are they coming towards freer political systems and freer economic systems? Or are they regressing? In the case of Uzbekistan, there was no doubt in my mind but that they did not have the kind of a freer political and freer economic system we did, but that they were moving in that direction. And the result of U.S. government action was to criticize them, I think, before the facts were known and certain, and cause them to go away from where we wanted them to go, to move regressively, if you will, towards less free political system and less free economic system, and simultaneously damage our security relationship with Uzbekistan, a country that was being very cooperative in terms of overflight, very cooperative in terms of use of the base at K2, and with a country that we were developing improving relations with. And instead, by our behavior, I think, prejudging what went on, we not only damaged our security, a relationship with Uzbekistan, but in addition, we shoved them back to a more regressive stance, which I think the words of the leadership there clearly indicated.
That was James Kirchick's interview with former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. They covered a lot of ground that was not included in this podcast. If you want to read the full transcript, it's available on our website, rferl.org.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
WikiLeaks made headlines over the last year by exposing the inner workings of the U.S. government and military. But the organization itself has been criticized for a lack of transparency about how it operates. In an interview with correspondent Kristen Deasy, WikiLeaks spokesman Kristen Raffensen responded to critics and outlined his organization's goals and methods.
WikiLeaks began as a hackers collective, more or less. So are there any proactive ways you guys are going after getting certain information, or you're just taking what people sort of bring to you?
There is no hacking involved in WikiLeaks and no proactive work getting information. We are on the receiving end, and we don't choose the topics of the content that is passed on to us, contrary to some claims. So we are passive recipients of information, and what we do is we verify the authenticity. We clean the material of all traces that could possibly point to the source, and we then get it out to the public, either by directly posting it on our website or, as we have been doing in the last few months, entering into a direct cooperation with the mainstream media in analyzing the material and publishing stories based on them.
Some critics of WikiLeaks say that they sort of adhere to a double standard, if you will, by demanding such a high level of transparency from, say, corporations to government officials, yet these critics claim that WikiLeaks itself is not that transparent. Can you give me more of a sense as to if there are conversations about, say, the moral pros and cons of releasing a document versus not releasing a document, or is everything just released in the name of transparency?
Well, I mean, we are very transparent in the way what we do. We are working, everybody knows what we are publishing. It is true that some of our people are working without having their identity known. I think that should be understandable in light of the threats and the attacks that the organization has been under. These are people that have to think about their family and their security, and some of them are contributing part-time. Apart from that, it is very hard to equate the part secrecy of the operation of WikiLeaks to the secrecy of a military organization or a government with large powers or a large corporation. It's hard to equate that together in my mind. Overall, I mean, I think it's pretty well known what WikiLeaks does and how it operates.
That said, I mean, there are people who used to work with WikiLeaks that have also criticized the organization for not being as open as it could be. So is there something more that WikiLeaks could be doing?
Well, if you are mentioning the small group of people that decided to leave the organization in the middle of last year, as far as I know, some of them are still anonymous and working in a not a very transparent manner. That said, I mean, WikiLeaks has been striving to make it quite well known how it operates.
Some people say that WikiLeaks is the modern technological equivalent of the brown envelope, the anonymous submission that New York Times and various other media organizations would get in years past. Now, of course, the whole scene has shifted, and there are some people saying that WikiLeaks is sort of the one that's now receiving the envelope, if you will. The difference being, if the New York Times got this information, they would offer a right of rebuttal to the other interested parties in the last huge release, the obvious people would be those of the U.S. State Department, for example. Do you think that that's something that WikiLeaks should be doing?
Well, why is there a need for rebuttal, a chance to rebuttal the material that we have been publishing? The material speaks out for itself. It is authentic. Nobody has claimed that it is not. By publishing the material, people can evaluate it on its own merit. It is not like we are publishing a claim that by somebody that has to be, there is no need for a right to reply when we are dealing with material of this nature.
Obviously, people have lots of different reasons they submit information to you, right? Maybe they have an axe to grind, or maybe they really think that it should be out there for the public interest. How do you weigh that? How do you vet that?
Well, I mean, you weigh the information on the same basis as any editorial office of any media would weigh information that gets to their inbox. I mean, this is basically a journalistic call.
That's why I was wondering if there are some things that you always take into account when you decide whether or not to release it to the public. Is this company-wide policy, if you will, or?
Well, evaluating what should be in the public domain is something that a journalist is doing every day when he gets information. There is, it's hard to point at a certain rigid rules with regard to that because every material is unique. But it is pretty much a journalistic evaluation.
Does it go to anybody for approval?
Well, material is evaluated by a group of people within WikiLeaks, but it's in the end, it's the call of the editor, as with traditional media.
Oftentimes, I think you're the one always having to answer the questions, but let me just ask you, do you have anything that you think is generally misunderstood by the media in regards to WikiLeaks?
There's a lot of misunderstanding about WikiLeaks and has been going on, but this is changing gradually. I feel the traditional media is more and more seeing that WikiLeaks is an addition to the media landscape, and it has very much changed the landscape of the media in the last few months, even to the extent that some of big media or traditional media operations are waiting the option or have already done that to open up a similar gateway in on their own website. So this is there is gradually more and more understanding of what WikiLeaks is doing and the necessity of the work here with regard to increasing transparency.
That was correspondent Kristen Deasy's interview with WikiLeaks spokesman Kristen Raffensen. Now it's time for our regular segment we call Uncovered. That's where we dig a little deeper and look at some of the best original reporting coming out of RFURL's 20 local bureaus. These are stories that are often underreported or uncovered by the Western media. This week I'm talking with editors Pete Baumgartner and Merhat Sharapjan in our studios in Prague. Let's start with Merhat. Our story we've done this week about a prominent Uzbek rights activist. He's sitting in a Kyrgyz prison right now serving a life sentence. What's the story there?
I have to mention here that he is a Kyrgyz human rights activist of Uzbek origin. So he's serving his term in his own country. The story here is the tragic events last year in June when local Uzbeks and Kyrgyz clashed in Kyrgyzstan's southern regions of Osh and Jalalabad, left more than 400 people dead, and many people were found guilty in different episodes of this tragedy. In this case, the situation is unique because Azimjan Askarov, he's a prominent Kyrgyzstani human rights activist, and he's well known not only domestically inside Kyrgyzstan, but he was also known around Central Asia for his human rights activities. He was found guilty in participation in killing of a policeman, brutal killing, in Jalalabad Oblast last year, and sentenced to life in prison in September. Our radio correspondents in Bishkek interviewed him on Tuesday in jail. He says he's not guilty. He says that he was only jailed because of his activities and that his sentence is retaliation of local police and prosecutors for his activities. There's a lot of controversy here. Of course, he showed his body to our correspondent there traces of beating.
But there was no substantial evidence presented at trial against him regarding the death of the police officer?
The substantial evidence was the testimonies of co-defendants, who also sentenced to life in prison. There were a different kind of videotapes showing his presence there, but we don't know what he was doing there. He was shouting there, but there was no voice, and probably he was trying to stop them, or on the contrary, he was trying to encourage them. It's very hard to say. Anyway, any person deserves fair trial and fair representation of his or her rights through lawyers. That was not the case in this situation.
Okay, well, let's turn to another item out of Kyrgyzstan that we've got. After the deadly clashes last year that Mirhat mentioned, local authorities in the Osh region have come up with a novel way to keep mixed Kyrgyz-Uzbek couples from moving away. Pete, do you know about that story?
Yeah, on Monday, a mixed Kyrgyz-Uzbek newlywed couple received 100,000 psalms, which is the equivalent of about $2,100. And they got that just for marrying each other. It's an initiative by a local government in southern Kyrgyzstan, actually in the district of Karasu, which is near Osh, where a lot of the unrest took place last June. And yeah, it's an interesting initiative. This is the first time it took the money was awarded. And yeah, we'll see if how many other couples sign up for matrimony just to get a little bit of money.
Yeah, I just want to add that in the beginning, local authorities announced this program to attract young teachers to stay in that region. But then young teachers were supposed to receive $400 for their decision to stay in that region. But those who are members of mixed families, if at least one of these partners in the mixed family is a teacher, was promised to be given over $2,000. And then a local population protested, saying that it's not only about teachers, we have many other people who deserve that. And it looks like they changed this idea and are giving this money not only to the families where teachers are other members of these mixed families.
Let's turn over to Serbia. The most wanted Bosnian Serb war crime suspect is General Ratko Mladic, who's been hiding and on the run for many years. The Serbian government's been working for closer ties with the EU, and they pledged to find and arrest him if possible. But now we hear that Mladic's friend and family doctor has been appointed to a Serbian cabinet post. What do you make of that?
Well, it's very unusual, I think. Yesterday, Zoran Stanković, who's a pathologist and was a very close friend of Mladic and his family, serving as his family doctor, including during the 92-95 Bosnian Civil War, was voted yesterday along with the rest of the cabinet as a health minister. And it certainly presents a difficult situation, I think, for the at least internationally for the Serbian government, because it doesn't look too optically, it doesn't look too good.
Does it send a signal inside the country? Is it? He hasn't done anything wrong per se, but.
Yeah, just because he was with Mladic doesn't mean that he committed any crimes. In fact, he hasn't been accused of committing any crimes, although a lot of people do think that he helped shelter Mladic in recent years, even going back to 2002 at a military medical academy that Stanković was the head of. I think probably nationalists in Serbia are probably pretty happy with this appointment, and perhaps that's what the appointment was supposed to do, was to make them happy.
Okay, Pete Baumgartner, Mirhat Sharabjan, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
С вами Радио Свобода.
Радио Фарда Кушника.
Айче Радио Европа.
Машал Радио.
Азатлик Радиосы.
Азатություն ГТМ.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
You're listening to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. For decades, parents have complained about their kids' love of rock and rap music, and the kids just loved it that much more. Now the Uzbek government, which has some familiarity with playing a paternal role, is also showing its displeasure. It's part of a campaign to mold model citizens in Uzbekistan, citizens who avoid the excesses of both East and West. Correspondent Bruce Panier reports.
Songs like this one by Uzbek rapper Shahrukh are examples of satanic music created by evil forces and are approaching as dark clouds over the heads of Uzbek youth. So says Uzbek state media, which launched a morality campaign against rock and rap in February. Uzbeks, especially young people, are being told more and more often how they should behave, what they should wear, and most importantly, who and what to avoid. Recently, Uzbek TV's second channel aired a documentary with the melodramatic title Melody and Calamity. The film solemnly but bizarrely declared that rock music originated from African hunting rituals, and it informed viewers that rap was invented by prison inmates, concluding, in all seriousness, that's why rap singers wear wide and long trousers. Davron Gayipov is an award-winning Uzbek musician who's been playing rock and roll ever since the 1980s. He says the documentary has it all wrong.
Some people should read up on rock and roll and rap. To say this is satanic music is simply not true. If we look at rock and roll music, we can hear rhythms familiar from Central Asia. If you listen to former Deep Purple guitarist Richie Blackmore, you can hear our rhythms.
Gayipov even says it's possible to hear in some of Pink Floyd's music the rhythms of the Shashmakam Six Modes classical music of Central Asia that dates back to the 16th century. Considering Uzbekistan's proximity to Afghanistan and the multiplying number of opposition groups in the Central Asian region rallying under the banner of Islam, perhaps it should not be surprising that Uzbek media dedicate programs and articles denouncing and warning about alien ideas. But increasingly, it is not Islamic extremists and Islamic clothing that state media criticize, but Western culture and technology. An article in the newspaper Halk Suzi urged Uzbek women to forego the veil, ending by saying, "Unfortunately, we have been observing girls wearing skirts with a hemline above the knees or revealing clothes showing their navels without being ashamed." It went on to say that this type of dressing style is not only alien to our centuries-old national and spiritual traditions, but also directly harmful to women's health. The Uzbek state media certainly has a rocky road ahead of it to influence the hearts and minds of the country's youth. In the 1950s and 60s, the West had its own struggle with ever more revealing clothing and so-called devil music. From Elvis to the Beatles to Led Zeppelin and beyond, it was a long, drawn-out cultural battle. But as governments and parents almost always learn, rap and rock and roll are here to stay.
That was Bruce Panier reporting. And that's all the rockin' in the free world we have for this week. I'm Bruce Jacobs. Thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Keladi erta indin mani so'rab degan savolga javob bila yo'q yoki adila ketmaga totadi kunlarim jim o'tadi nazarim mani ko'chada yo'lada balki aynan o'tgan ketganlarga qarab havas qilaman ula oila ula ota bola dunyoda eng yaqin insonlar bir-biriga davom etadi hayot davom etadi Kino qayta qo'yganda niyatda kun ham o'tadi Nazarimda ostonadan ota-onam Olim bugun uyga qaytamiz